This is the NPR News Update. It's Minnesota's news on your schedule. Friday, August 2nd, I'm John Wanamaker. The four Republican candidates for governor say they want to repeal Minnesota's health insurance exchange, which was created under President Obama's federal health care law. The candidates made the comments last night at a gubernatorial forum in Moundsview. Republican State Representative Kurt Zeller says he doesn't think the health insurance exchange can be fixed and would work to end it if he's elected governor.
You can't fix it. You start by defunding it. You start by pulling the staff away. And then you offer a solution. Because as Republicans, we can't always be the party of no. We have to offer a solution.
The state would have to rely on a federal health insurance exchange if the state exchange is repealed. DFL Governor Mark Dayton and the DFL-controlled legislature created the exchange, an online marketplace that allows individuals to buy health insurance. The site is expected to go live this fall. Cheers erupted outside the Clay County Courthouse in Moorhead after 19 couples exchanged midnight marriage vows early Thursday. District Court Judge Lisa Borgen told the couples she was honored to be part of the historic event.
From this day forward, you are family, not just because you love each other or live with each other, but because you are legally bound in marriage.
But the legal marriage disappears when the couples drive across the Red River into North Dakota, where the state constitution bans same-sex marriage. Dan Gunderson explains some of the challenges faced by same-sex couples living and working in border communities.
Marriage means security for 36-year-old Mara Morkin. She's a stay-at-home mom with two children. Her partner, Alex Fogarty, teaches at Minnesota State University in Moorhead. The couple will marry next week. Morkin says that means she won't have to worry about medical insurance for her family or financial benefits if her spouse dies. But there are some issues she's worried about because she lives on the North Dakota border. The couple's home is in Moorhead, but we meet in a Fargo park to talk while her son plays.
It's been interesting driving back and forth between Moorhead and Fargo, which we do, you know, a few times every day, thinking every time I drive across this bridge, I won't be married anymore. My family won't be considered a family. The biggest concern for us is health care.
That's because all of the hospitals are in Fargo. The nearest Minnesota hospital is about an hour away.
So, for instance, if something terrible happens to one of us, and we need to be rushed to the emergency room, if we don't have healthcare proxies or healthcare directives with us at that moment, we won't have any power as a married couple.
And if Morkin has another child in a Fargo hospital, she'll be considered a single mother. And legal protections for married couples will not extend across state lines. For example, Morkin says if one spouse is injured or killed in North Dakota, the other spouse couldn't sue for damages. Mara Morkin grew up in Moorhead. She met Alex Fogarty in New York. The couple moved to Fargo-Moorhead 3 years ago. Fogarty holds 3-month-old Violet as she talks. She says the state border barrier to equal rights is frustrating, but she's taking a long view. She thinks North Dakota will change.
I think Fargo's an incredibly progressive city with really cool people, and I think they value diversity, they value quality, and so I'm hopeful that, you know, the influence that the city has can really spread throughout the rest of the state. And some states can go down, you know, kicking and screaming. But we'll get there.
There's no guarantee that will happen in North Dakota. The definition of marriage is enshrined in the state constitution. And it might take a while to work out the cross-border issues raised by same-sex marriage, says Fargo family law attorney Alicia Ankers.
People like to have predictability, and they should have that. We should know what the rules are when we live our lives. And right now, we don't know what all the rules are with regard to the same-sex marriage. And so while there's a lot of exuberance and excitement, there's also a lot of ghosts and goblins hanging out there in terms of what this really means for families trying to cross state lines.
Some couples will marry in Minnesota but continue to live in North Dakota. The marriage won't be recognized by the state of North Dakota, but it should be recognized by the federal government because of a recent Supreme Court ruling. But that will also take some time, according to Jana Curran with the American Civil Liberties Union. She says it comes down to a matter of semantics. Different federal agencies use different language to define marriage. Some go by where a couple was married. Others rely on where a couple lives.
The military has places of celebration. So if you get married in Minnesota and you're a same-sex couple and you go back to the Minot Air Force Base, for example, spousal benefits will be, you know, automatically recognized. Many of the other ones are place of residence. So that will take some time to work through all of those. But we are confident given time, everyone will be able to access these rights regardless if you live in North Dakota or Minnesota.
Social Security benefits are based on where you live, so North Dakota residents who marry in Minnesota won't be eligible for spousal Social Security benefits, at least until the rules are changed. Corinne says those federal regulatory changes could take a year or longer. In the meantime, at least one Fargo couple who were married today in Moorhead is considering legal action to have their marriage recognized in North Dakota. Dan Gunderson, Minnesota Public Radio News, Fargo.
State lawmakers gave a lot more money to public schools this year, but some school districts are still planning to ask local taxpayers this fall for more. Democrats say the proposed operating levy votes show that districts are still in a catch-up mode after too many lean years. But Republicans say schools wouldn't need so much money if the legislature would stop micromanaging them. Tim Pugmire has more.
With a $485 million increase in spending over the next 2 years, DFL lawmakers described the 2013 education bill as one of the best ever. They also predicted the new money would turn the school financing tide of the past decade. That's why DFL Representative Paul Marquardt of Dilworth, chair of the House Education Finance Committee, said he's not surprised that some districts still need more.
You know, we went 10 years where we were underfunding our schools. And even though this year's education finance bill was pretty significant, you don't make up in 1 year for 10 years of disinvestment.
It's still not clear how many school districts will ask voters to increase an operating levy this fall, even though lawmakers set a June 30th deadline for school boards to make their intention known in a resolution. That so-called referendum freeze does not apply to levy renewal attempts. Districts that don't currently have an operating levy in place, or those trying to work out of statutory debt. Representative Marquardt described the provision as a soft freeze, which was intended to send a message to school leaders.
One of the main things we want to do is lessen the reliance on property taxes and funding education, because we know that creates great disparities between the wealthy districts and the poor districts. And so, you know, the next couple years, you're getting new money, you know, think twice before you go to a referendum, because we want to keep property taxes down.
But the early deadline didn't give school boards a lot of time to think. Scott Kroonquist, executive director of the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, said some of his members adopted resolutions just to keep the referendum option alive until they make firm commitments. He said referendum votes might be coming in up to half of his organization's 40 districts, including Eden Prairie, Osseo, Roseville, South Washington County, and Stillwater. As for the state funding increase, Kroonquist said it wasn't really as big as some people think.
In the final analysis, the legislature provided about an inflationary increase for education over the next 2 years. So clearly, the need to conduct operating referenda has not gone away. Operating referendums continue to provide a significant source of funds for our school districts. Some districts receive more than 20% of their operating revenue from a local voter-approved referendum.
The lead Republican on the House Education Finance Committee, Representative Kelby Woodard of Belle Plaine, said he believes the problem for school districts is not the amount of state funding, but that it comes with too many strings attached. He pointed specifically to the $134 million earmarked for all-day kindergarten. Woodard said districts need more flexibility in their spending decisions.
Whether it's maintenance on buildings, whether it's you want to hire some aides in your science program or in your math program, you spend it the way you know that your community needs it, as opposed to the Minnesota legislature saying, here's where you need to spend this money. And it's the same all across the state. That's how you help that operating levy issue.
Lawmakers provided a new option for school districts that have not been able to pass operating referenda. School boards in those districts now have the authority to levy up to $300 per student without putting the measure to voters. School districts with high operating costs also have the ability to convert a portion of their voter-approved levy to the board-approved classification. Tim Pugmire, Minnesota Public Radio News at the Capitol.
This is the NPR News Update. We come your way every day around noon. It's Minnesota's news on your schedule. Governor Mark Dayton is in preliminary talks with legislative leaders about calling a one-day special session for disaster relief. Tom Tom Scheck reports.
Dayton spokesman Bob Hume says Dayton would like to call the special session to ensure that the state's share of disaster aid is directed as quickly as possible to 18 counties. President Obama recently declared those counties a disaster area after storms in late June caused damage to trees and power lines and caused flooding. Hume says the special session is needed to ensure that the state's share of the $17.8 million in damages is paid for.
The state has to pay a share to get this money out to the people who need it, and we need a legislative appropriation to do that. At least that's our assessment, you know, as it stands, which is why we've started very early talks.
Hume says it's too early to say when Dayton would call the special session. Tom Scheck, Minnesota Public Radio News at the Capitol.
The Minneapolis City Council is weighing whether the city should form its own gas and electrical utilities. The city's franchise agreements with CenterPoint Energy and XL Energy expire next year. Citizens on both sides of the issue gave council members an earful at a packed public hearing on Thursday. Elizabeth Dunbar was there, and she has this report.
When do we want
energy?
When do we want it?
Now!
About 150 members of Minneapolis Energy Options gathered outside City Hall before the hearing in their yellow T-shirts. The group wants the City Council to let Minneapolis residents vote in November to move toward forming the city's own utility. Javier Morillo, who represents the Service Employees International Union, spoke at the rally.
With the science of what is going on in our world today, we are going to have to make radical changes to the way we live. And we better be on the front end of that.
Concerns about climate change have been the main driver of discussions about forming a municipal utility. The city's climate change action plan calls for a 30% reduction in the city's greenhouse gas emissions by 2025. But inside the city council chambers, the voices against the proposal outweighed those in favor for most of the hearing. Councilmember Elizabeth Glidden chaired the hearing, which needed two overflow rooms to accommodate everyone.
We do have a time clock, and this is our first time using it.
Dozens of people who spoke were limited to 3 minutes apiece. The utilities were given more time to present their arguments. CenterPoint Energy has already negotiated with Minneapolis Energy Options and committed to reducing emissions, so most of the hearing focused on XL. Regional Vice President Laura McCartan says it could cost the city billions to buy all of XL's power lines and assets and begin running its own operation.
You would be responsible for billing, new construction, power outage restoration, the cold weather rule, and hundreds of other issues that utilities deal with every day because it is a complex business. We see this turning into a lose-lose scenario pretty quickly.
Some critics of the ballot measure pointed out that as a municipal utility, unlike XL, Minneapolis wouldn't need state approval to raise rates. Citizens and business groups who spoke against the proposal cited the potential for higher utility bills. Larry Lura says it would hurt low-income residents the hardest.
That's going to pull more money out of my pockets, and people like myself who are in a marginal economy where we can barely pay our own bills. It would be a detriment to myself and those like myself who were just barely making it.
We gain nothing by becoming an island.
Bill Jonason, president of the Minneapolis Regional Chamber of Commerce, says by forming a municipal utility, Minneapolis would cut itself off from a system that's working well.
You would abandon a regional power system operated by a company that is a national leader in the use of wind and other sustainable sources of energy. Minneapolis is part of a regional system. Let's not waste time trying to fix something that isn't broken while many other areas demand our attention.
But supporters emphasize that even if voters do direct the city to form a municipal utility, leaders could decide not to do it. Community organizer Timothy Denherter-Thomas says the city should at least consider a change.
I think the core question here that's in front of us is, does it make sense for Minneapolis to join cities like Seattle, Los Angeles, San Antonio, and Omaha to pursue their own utilities, and can that deliver the types of improvements and in lower rates and more reliable energy and, you know, more clean energy that other cities have been able to achieve? I believe that we should at least find out.
A feasibility study is underway, but it won't be done until after the November election, when voters could ask the city to move forward with forming its own utility. The city council is expected to vote in 2 weeks on whether to give voters that choice.
That's reporter Elizabeth Dunbar. Starting next year, more than half of Minnesota's counties will add a $10 wheelage tax to car and truck tab renewal fees. Mark Zedeklik has details.
The Association of Minnesota Counties says 47 of Minnesota's 87 counties will charge wheelage taxes. Until now, only the seven metro area counties had authority to charge the tax. Five of them did. This year, the legislature extended the taxing authority to all Minnesota counties and doubled the tax from $5 to $10. Proceeds from the tax must be used for road and bridge work. Critics say counties that collect the tax don't have to spend more than they otherwise would on transportation, and they predict the tax will lead to higher spending in other areas. 70% of Minnesotans live in the 47 counties that decided to impose the wheelage tax next year. Mark Zedeklik, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Granite Falls Energy has purchased a majority interest in a financially struggling Southwest Minnesota ethanol company once valued at $55 million. Terms of the new deal were not disclosed. Mark Stile reports.
Granite Falls will assume management of the Heron Lake Bioenergy Plant. Both operations are in the southwest part of the state. Heron Lake has been in financial trouble for over a year. Last January, there was an agreement to sell the Heron Lake facility, but that deal later fell through. Both Granite Falls Energy and the Heron Lake plant produce about 60 million gallons of ethanol annually. The ethanol industry has struggled over the past year, mainly because the cost of its principal ingredient, corn, surged to record levels. But the outlook is better now for the industry because it's expected U.S. farmers will harvest large amounts of corn this fall, causing the price of the grain to fall. Mark Stile, Minnesota Public Radio News, Worthington.
And that's the NPR News Update for Friday, August 2nd. I'm John Wanamaker. Thanks for listening.